our ability to make decisions, make choices, is under our own control, right? Well, maybe not. When we feel we don't have options or freedom to choose, we feel constricted, but we have to learn there are things out of our control in life. When we feel like we're on the edge, it's as if we've been tossed overboard and now have to decide whether to sink or swim. There are no winners, only a single loser. And in those moments, in those decisions, we often find our deepest regrets. Hey everyone, welcome to the Dead Name Mac podcast, a show that dives into the lives and minds of regular parents just like you and me to share why parenthood is both the most challenging and the most rewarding experience you can have in life. We'll discuss the complexities of the issues and challenges we all face along our journeys as humans and gain a deeper understanding of the personal transformations we go through along the way. Maybe you're someone who's on the fence about having kids, or maybe you know you want them and are struggling to determine if you're ready, or maybe you already have them and you are feeling like you've hit a wall of uncertainty in your life. This podcast is for you. I'm your host, Mac, and I'm a millennial dad in my 30s who is constantly seeking new ways to improve and optimize the parent experience to find the right balance between parental responsibilities and self-fulfillment. I hope you'll join me on this journey to better understand the importance of parenthood and how we can make a difference and a positive impact on the world as parents. Hey everyone. Welcome to the Dad Name Mac podcast. Today is Sunday, June 16th, 2024. It's Father's Day, a day to celebrate all the dads out there. I hope you can take a moment to reach out to a dad you know, your dad, grandpa, friend, relative, and let them know that you love them and give them some encouragement to keep grinding and dadding hard. It's not an easy job being a parent, and you have to give up a part of yourself. And it's so important to recognize that sacrifice by all the parents out there. Now, this is our second full episode. If you happen to catch my previous episode about my recent midlife crisis experience, you may be wondering, what is the reality of human nature? Well, today I'm going to begin explaining, and I hope you'll follow along throughout the series. Make sure to follow the podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or iHeartRadio. Or if you're a more visual learner, check out my YouTube channel, Dead Name Mac, and consider subscribing. And if the podcast leaves you thinking a little bit more, please consider rating and sharing so we can continue to reach others who may be seeking answers and understanding for themselves. Now, are you someone who sometimes feels overwhelmed at restaurants when looking at the menu? Do you find yourself spending 15 minutes choosing the right $2 box of pasta at the grocery store? What about when you have to decide what to wear? From the moment we wake up in the morning, we are faced with constant choices. Something as trivial as deciding which shirt to wear or which cereal to eat in the morning requires brain power. It requires energy. And as we go throughout each day, each week, we continually burn this energy making choices. And sometimes when we are faced with a curveball, like a big decision or problem that we aren't used to making, it can cause us to panic. We feel a level of stress and anxiety because we have to deal with something that requires additional energy and thought, and if we've already burned off our reserves making simple everyday choices, these bigger decisions can push us over the edge. We are all naturally creatures of habit, and we don't like it when something unexpected happens. But when it does, we're put on our toes, and this anxiety we feel is a form of excitement that I believe we should all strive to understand and seek out in some cases. When we feel like we're on the edge, that increased level of brain power it takes to manage a situation or deal with a problem is triggered automatically. It's as if we've been tossed overboard and now have to decide whether to sink or swim. And in these moments, we start living. Now, have you ever heard of the game Jenga? I'm sure 99% of you have, but for that one guy or girl who hasn't, it's a fun children's game made of small wooden blocks that can be played alone or with others. There's no board for the game, but rather the blocks are set up in a tower made of levels, each with three blocks. Now, each level is oriented differently in a crisscross pattern if you were to look at it from above. And to play the game, you take turns removing single blocks from any level below the highest complete level of the tower, and then placing them on top to create new levels. As you do this, the tower gets taller and taller and slowly becomes less and less stable until it eventually collapses and the game ends. It's such a simple game. So simple that my 3-year-old can play it with me. And simple enough to where it almost seems like it would be a boring game. A And yet it's one that has stood the test of time over the last nearly 40 years as a popular game. It's been so popular that it was actually inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame in 2020. And its simplicity is what makes it popular. Someone who is 32 can have just as much fun playing it as a 3-year-old. But why is that? Shouldn't a game as straightforward as stacking blocks be too basic for an adult to enjoy? I think what makes the game fun is the excitement that comes from the instability of the tower as you get deeper into the game. That anxiety of choosing the right block and feeling the pressure we feel as we slowly start pulling from the tower causes us to focus, causes us to think and feel and be in that moment as we make our move. The game triggers that same awareness we get in life when we are faced with a tough decision or problem. That's why I believe we enjoy it as adults. Let's shift gears. If playing Jenga by yourself, the objective of the game is to build as tall a tower as you can. If you're playing with others, the goal is effectively the same, but the unfortunate player who causes the tower to fall is the loser of the round. In essence, whether playing by yourself or with a group, there are no winners, only a single loser. The name of the game, Jenga, is a form of the Swahili word kujenga, which means to build. The game's creator, Leslie Scott, grew up living in various African countries and chose the name because she knew it would be unique. I went on to learn that when Scott originally put the game on the market in the 1980s, it was called Jenga the Perpetual Challenge. But Hasbro, the American game conglomerate, didn't like the word perpetual as they felt it wouldn't be understood. So they dropped it and shortened the name to simply Jenga. Now, why is that? Perpetual means never ending. It's a very basic word. Why would people in America, a somewhat well-educated country, not understand? Well, here in the States, our culture revolves around competition and pushes the concept of winners and losers on us from a very early age. You should strive to be a winner in life, and to become one requires beating others by outdoing them, outlasting them, earning more than them, buying a bigger house, having a nicer car, raising children that are smarter, more athletic, more successful. And along with this concept, we're often taught that to win, others have to lose. We're taught to want to be the best. If you ain't first or last, we're pitted against each other in a way. In most sports, it's evident who is the winner and who is the loser. But in life, we can only convince ourselves of the result by comparison to those around us. I'm a winner if I have more money than you. I'm a winner if my partner is more physically attractive than yours. I'm a winner if I have a better job title than you. And when we achieve these apparent end goals of victory, we've been conditioned to do what we can to make them known, because if you don't flaunt your victories, how will you separate yourself as a winner from the losers? How will everyone else know you beat them? So in the context of the game of Jenga, I believe Hasbro felt including the word perpetual in the name would imply it was a never-ending game. And if the game never ends, how do you win? How do you lose? Americans wouldn't understand playing a game without winners and losers, which means they wouldn't buy it. So they changed it. But I think it's meant to be a game that you play over and over and over, where you constantly strive to beat your last score and build a taller tower. That's the goal when you play alone, and it's the same when you play with others, but you just have others helping you. You aren't necessarily competing against each other, but rather you are working together to avoid failure. A concept that isn't great for business, but one that should be practiced in our lives. Now, we used to have a couple Jenga sets in my parents' house growing up, but we rarely used them to play the actual game. I'd build houses or other structures for my action figures instead, which definitely seemed like a better use for the blocks. In college, Jenga popped up again, but again, we wouldn't play the game itself. We just use it as yet another opportunity to create a more exciting way to get drunk. In typical creative college-mindedness, the game became Drunk Jenga, and we would write various rules on each block, such as girls drink, or chug your beer, or take a shot. I'll skip ahead to now, and I had this urge to want to play Jenga, and with our daughter being 3, I figured she was now old enough and coordinated enough to play, so I grabbed a set off Amazon. We started playing, and at first, she wasn't really grasping the concept of finding the loose blocks, so the game would end quickly. but after several rounds, she was starting to get it. I could see the focus on her face as she tested the looseness of certain blocks and could almost feel her anxiety over choosing the right one, especially as our tower grew. I'm honestly not sure I've ever seen her that locked in on anything before. And that's what got me thinking. Why would such a simple game cause so much mental strain in a child? Was it the inability to understand the physics of the tower and seeing the weak points? Or perhaps it was the sound of the blocks falling on the table, causing a loud, startling noise that she wanted to avoid? Possibly. But most likely, it was just that it was taking all of her mental strength to coordinate her eyes and hands to avoid destroying the tower. But as I thought harder about this game, I realized it is the perfect metaphor for life. It's about so much more than pulling and stacking blocks. But because it is so simple, it can be easily understood. It can be taught, clearly, in a way that just makes sense. And as the idea started swirling in my head, I knew this game was the perfect way, the perfect model, to explain what I had been thinking and the questions I had been asking myself lately. So much so that I actually bought a second set of the game and hand-painted the blocks with my daughter and wife's help to use as a visual, although I definitely don't recommend that as it was a pain in the butt, and I'm sure you can just buy a colored set, but it made for some fun video clips that I'll explain in the next few episodes in the series. But in today's episode, we will just be getting our feet wet, dipping our toes into the power of Jenga, which I am now deeming the true game of life. That other old board game called Life is trash. If you've ever played it, you'll know you almost always end the game with a minivan full of six kids, a career you hate, and a giant pile of debt. Jenga, on the other hand, is a game of levels, and there are layers upon layers of knowledge and life lessons to unveil, each one with a deeper meaning. Just as we stack and build, we can use this model to teach our kids these lessons if we can learn them ourselves. It's a perpetual loop. In my mind, at the surface level, Jenga presents us with two of the most basic but most important concepts that children can learn and begin to understand from toddlerhood: the concepts of choice and control. And these are what we'll focus on today. So let's get into it. The game of Jenga, outside of being a physical challenge for children who are still developing, requires you to make constant choices. Each turn, you are presented with a multitude of blocks to choose to pull. Some are easier than others, some are harder. Some are right in front of you, while some you have to move around the table to see. In each turn, you have to live with the consequences of your choice. If you're playing with others, you have to live and react to their choices as well. Each move you make requires you to choose a block to remove from the tower and place it on top in a new level. The objective, being to create as tall a tower as possible, becomes increasingly difficult as more blocks are removed, making the tower less stable. At the beginning of the game, the choices are fairly simple. The tower is solid and sturdy with all of the blocks in their perfectly organized positions. You can poke around and find loose blocks all over, sometimes some that just seem to slide out on their own. Now, placing them on top is just as easy at the start because you don't have to worry about the tower being off balance. You don't have to think about counterweighting one side or the other. So logically, the beginning of the game should go at a relatively quick pace. However, when playing with my daughter, it can take her a while to pick because there are too many options and it throws her for a loop. She is experiencing an example of one of the most prevalent issues we face in life, and we face a lot of them. But this is the paradox of choice. Now, what is that exactly? Well, while we strive to have more freedom, to have choices in our lives, we so often find ourselves confused, almost paralyzed when we are presented with too many options. The overabundance of options binds us and leaves us feeling trapped and less free in a sense. As we grow up into adulthood, we are constantly exposed to this paradox. Just think about the number of instances you encounter this in a typical week or day. Think about those examples mentioned earlier, like choosing what to wear or what brand of pasta to buy. As parents, we have to choose which stroller, car seat, or baby monitor to get. And we try to watch review videos to help us make our decisions, but there are so many freaking options. Different styles, different features, different price points. We are constantly faced with choices in today's world that just have absurd amounts of options to pick from. And having to make these choices wears on us until we just get fed up and tired of making them. And this is called choice overload. The positive feeling we had at the start, having freedom to choose whichever option we wanted, slowly fades away and pushes us towards negative emotions and fatigue. But on the flip side, when we feel we don't have options, or freedom to choose, we feel constricted, which can make us feel just as exhausted and frustrated, if not more. So it follows there is an optimal middle ground between the points of having no options and having too many options. We want to have some, but not too many. And we most strongly desire this optionality in the biggest decisions in our lives, which happen to be the ones where it is most difficult to find it, like where we can afford to buy a home, which car to buy, what daycare or school to send our kids to. Those trivial decisions we make regularly exhaust our wallets and our brains, limiting our ability to pursue the options and opportunities we want most. Circling back to the issue I saw my daughter struggling with, she would freeze up initially when there were too many blocks to pick from, but it would become easier for her as we got past the first few moves. However, as we worked our way through the game, we hit a point of inflection where it started to become much more challenging and strategic because the options started to dwindle. As we pulled out more blocks from the original structure, it became less and less stable. And for anyone of any age, it takes more and more brain power to determine which block to choose. But especially for a 3-year-old, it really pushes her mental limits. And usually as we get to this point in the game, my daughter will start to give up. She'll say, "Daddy, can you pick for me?" Her first instinct is to rely on me as her parent to make the choice for her. She wants to avoid making a difficult decision, one that could result in her losing. And this avoidance strategy isn't something unique to her as a child. It's baked into all of us as humans. Avoiding the things that seem scary to us is ingrained in our DNA as a survival tactic. That fear of losing makes the choice harder, and as a child, whose most difficult decision each day is deciding which excuse to use to avoid going to bed at night, her mental willpower isn't strong enough to allow her to make the move. Mental willpower, or mental strength, is like a muscle. It's something that we all build over time as we are forced to start making choices in our lives. It gets stronger as we continue to face more and more choices, and as those choices become increasingly more difficult throughout life into adulthood, into parenthood, and beyond. Part of our growth into adulthood is not only being able to make tough choices, but being able to live with the consequences of those choices, which in reality is much easier said than done. And I'll discuss that a little bit more later on. But as you play the game of Jenga, you choose your block to pull, and once you get that bad boy more than halfway out, you're committed. The tower may fall or it may not, but you had the freedom to choose the block to pull. Your choices may have been limited, but you ultimately picked, and you have to live with the outcome. Kids avoid this. They aren't ready for it. That's where we come in as parents, to help teach them how to make their choices and own the consequences. But we need to understand how to do that ourselves first. And while this seems like a very simple concept on the surface, it's a level deeper than you'd expect. Let's consider an example of choice and consequence you may face as an adult in the workforce. In Jenga, when someone else threatens your tower's stability, it's easy to get defensive. Our instincts are immediately to react to what's occurred. And in that emotionally charged state is when the worst can be brought out of us. If your turn is before mine and you pull a block, putting me in a tough position on my turn, I'm going to get a little angry. I'm going to be frustrated that you made my choice more difficult. I'm already being overloaded with a number of choices by everyone else, so when your decision affects me in a negative way, it's going to piss me off a bit. Now say we are coworkers and we rely on each other's work. We may not really know each other very well, and we don't really know what the other one does at work in the day-to-day, but we know enough to accept there's a mutual relationship between our work. We don't talk outside of the moments that necessitate it typically. We're each just there, operating independently with the understanding that somehow our work ties together. But what happens when we run into problems? Problems that put us in jeopardy of losing our jobs. We blame each other. You didn't do your job, which is why I couldn't do mine. We point the finger at each other and search for any reason to not point the finger at ourselves. I've certainly been guilty of this on occasions, and why do we do this? Because it's the easiest thing to do. Why would I take time to think about all the things I did wrong or that I could have done better to avoid the issues when I can just victimize myself and place the blame on you? I don't want to take responsibility for my actions because I don't want to be at fault. It can't be my fault. We tell ourselves this over and over, and it's not my fault. It's not my fault. Because if it was, then I'd have to own up to the fact that I make mistakes. and the fear of losing my job is greater than my will to hold myself accountable. I can't afford to get fired. I need this job. I need to support my tower because my stability comes first. I have to support myself. I have a family to feed. This is what we tell ourselves in these moments, and ironically, it's almost the same thing as placing blame on another. I'm acting in a self-serving manner, unlike my true character, because I have a family. I don't know to my mistakes if they weren't there in the picture, but because they are, I have a duty to avoid getting fired, even if it's my fault. I have a duty to avoid this potential instability, this potential failure. It's one of the easiest excuses to make. And in doing so, we are acting egocentrically. My family, myself, my life is more important than yours. Rather than owning up and working together to find the best solution, the best path forward, we resort to projection, to blame. If you're going to pull a block that puts me in a tough position on my next move, I'm not thinking about making a move that will help us reach another level. I'm thinking about the move that I can make that will make your next move more difficult than mine, because I want you to feel that same pressure you made me feel. I want to shift the pressure, the anxiety, back to you because somehow knowing you feel it makes me feel a little bit better. I want you to lose so I can win. We do this in the heat of the moment. We lose focus. We let our emotions take over and make an irrational, out-of-character decision. And in those moments, in those decisions, we often find our deepest regrets. Now, it's easy to forget what moves you made earlier when you're hyper-focused on someone else's, but if you rewind the tape, maybe there was a different option, a better option that would have helped everyone avoid that instability or that failure. Maybe I did make the wrong move before, and now I'm faced with this tough choice, with this fear and anxiety because of something I did, something I had control over. When we start thinking this way, we become more accepting of the outcomes, of the consequences. This concept of control is therefore very closely tied to the concept of choice, and we're exposed to both of them early on in life. They are two of the most basic concepts we learn about through our daily life, often subconsciously. I don't know about you, but I sure never took a class on choices and control in school. I just grasped them on my own as they were necessary to live. Choices are all around us in just about everything we do. They're unavoidable. So it logically makes sense that we improve our ability to make them as we grow older and more mature. Control, on the other hand, is less obvious in our lives. We, as humans, we naturally want to feel a level of control in our lives. We need it. We need to feel a level of autonomy, of agency. Our actions are made under our own will and not dictated by anyone else. Our ability to make decisions, make choices, is under our own control, right? Well, maybe not. Did you actually choose what you wanted to wear to work last Monday, or were the clothes you picked chosen because your office has a dress code? Did you choose which way to drive your kid to daycare, or did you have to take a detour because there was an accident on your usual route? Did you just buy a new pair of sneakers you don't need because you really wanted to buy sneakers today? Or did you just do that because those dang marketing people placed a targeted ad on your Instagram feed? We want to feel in control and often convince ourselves we have it, when in reality, most of the choices we make are influenced or dictated by things out of our control. And this can confuse and frustrate us. We want to be in control to not only make our decisions, but we also desire to control the outcomes. But we have to learn there are things out of our control in life. And it's how we manage ourselves, how we manage our reactions, that can ultimately gain us back that control we seek. For my daughter playing Jenga, one of the most obvious things I noticed was her frustration when I made a move she either wasn't expecting or one that affected her in some way. The fact she was somewhat beholden to my choices as the other player in the game triggered her a bit. Maybe I'd grab the block she was eyeing, or as we neared the end of the game, I'd grab the last truly loose block, leaving her with really no options. You could just see her facial expression change as she realized she was most likely going to lose the game. Dealing with the outcomes from the choices of others is just as hard for adults as it is for children. Learning to accept that others have their own free will to make choices, to choose what to say, how to act, who to be friends with or not, who to spend holidays with, where to live, can be extremely difficult because, again, we as humans want to feel we are in control. We like feeling like we're in control. We like feeling that power. Our daughter is nearing the end of her toddler years. She started becoming more independent and she has clearly developed a new level of confidence. You can hear it in her tone when she talks and see it in her actions. She wants to get dressed herself. She wants to get her own snacks out of the pantry. She wants to buckle herself into the car seat and stroller. And she is starting to not ask, but demand things. Open my fruit pouch. Bring me a snack. Go get me my soccer ball. Now, why does she try to boss mom and dad around with her sassy attitude? Simple. She wants to be in control. She is testing us to understand her ability and power to control the world around her, including other people. This is one of the first major challenges I've had to navigate as a parent. Sure, there have been other struggles with sleeping and potty training, but this is much more complex. If we as parents were simply to oblige to every demand from our daughter, if we wouldn't say no, she'd start to develop a false sense of control. She'd start to believe she would get anything she wanted, which can be very problematic. If she feels she can demand anything of anyone, that she's entitled to whatever she wants, it will be that much more deflating when she realizes that others can choose to reject her wishes. On the flip side, if we were to deny every request she made and tell her she must listen to our every command, we would be stripping her of her independence and her opportunity to learn where the boundaries of control exist. And that's exactly it. There's a balance to target here, and the goal is to help our children understand that boundary between the controllables and the uncontrollables in life. At the toddler stage, kids haven't matured enough to manage their emotions or reactions to things outside of their control. So when we tell our daughter, "No, you can't watch TV because it's bedtime," she throws a tantrum and starts crying. Tantrums and crying are young children's way of expressing their frustration with their inability to maintain control. Teaching them to build mental strength against adversity, to control their emotions, and to focus on what they can do themselves to make the most of the situation is an extremely challenging task and one we must do our best to accomplish as parents. I'll tell her we can watch something in the morning, or tomorrow when you get home from school, you can choose to watch something instead of building awesome couch, pillow, and blanket forts. When I made my choice to take that last loose block in the game of Jenga, my daughter could have thrown a tantrum and quit, but I encouraged her to play on and make a choice of her own. My move was out of her control, and while it frustrated her, she eventually went for it and grabbed the best block she could. Crash. The tower collapsed, and while she was upset about losing the game, what she didn't realize was she was growing and winning in life. She took a risk, made a decision, and even though it didn't work out, she learned something. And the next time we play, she'll be a little more prepared. The more we play this children's game, and the more I pondered the concepts of choice and control, the more I started realizing how Jenga is an incredible representation of life in a multitude of other ways as well. We all begin as players in the game of Jenga with the ultimate goal of working together to build something great. We have to make choices throughout the game, just as we do in life, and the difficulty of those choices continues to increase as we grow into adulthood. Learning to be more thoughtful in our decisions and to manage our emotions and reactions to the decisions of others, which are out of our control, are critical parts of our self-development process as humans. We should all strive to continually improve upon these as adults, because as we improve our skills in these areas, we become more open-minded, more empathetic, allowing us to see the bigger picture of the game. It can be so easy to get lost in the moment where we see only winners and losers. This is how children think. But as adults, especially as parents, it is imperative that we focus on how to play the game to reach the highest heights we can. How can we approach our turn with others in mind? Can we learn to take risks that pay off for everyone? Can we make suggestions on moves to others that will make our tower stronger, that will help us all avoid instability? Can we work together to push the boundaries of what we think is possible? And when we do find ourselves in moments of failure, our lowest lows, how can we work together to build something new, something stronger? As we each learn how to play the game this way, we can begin to see it for what it is, just a game. And we can start to recognize the world around the game is something so much more. Only when we can remove ourselves from the game can we start to teach others to do the same, teach our children how to do the same. As an adult, as a parent, you have a level of agency that children do not, a level of freedom to decide to initiate the game. You must choose to play and whether to play the game with yourself or with others. For my daughter, she had no choice but to play because dad said we had to. She was brought into the game without choice. I made her play, told her what the rules were, what the objectives were, and often gave her directions on which moves to make. I wanted to help her succeed so she would become more interested and have fun, but also learn how to play the game and to improve her decision making. I tried asking her to play it again the other day, but she refused. We opted to have a daddy-daughter dance party instead, but at some point in the future, as she grows older, she'll have the opportunity to come back to the game, to choose to play for herself, and I hope she does. This has been Jenga, the True Game of Life Part 1 on the Dad Named Mac podcast. As always, thanks for watching, and thanks for listening.